Hello, everyone. This is Deepa Iyer, and you're listening to the first episode of Solidarity Is This in the new year. Thank you so much for sharing, supporting, and subscribing to this podcast, which explores the dynamics of solidarity practice, why we do it, how it's complicated and challenging, and what is required for us to engage in meaningful, long-term solidarity. The episode you're about to hear is called Not in Our Name, Resisting Hindu Fascism. That clip is from a protest I attended on a cold day in December 2019 in front of the Mahatma Gandhi statue in Washington, D.C. Indian students in the D.C. area had organized the protest to oppose a discriminatory citizenship law that had just been enacted in India. The Citizenship Amendment Bill fast-tracks Indian citizenship for certain faith minorities from neighboring countries. But the bill also has a clear anti-Muslim animus. It blocks naturalization of Muslim migrants. In addition, the Bharatiya Janata Party, led by India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, is planning to conduct a national count of India's citizens, which could mean that minority communities, Dalits and Muslims included, have to prove their citizenship through documents that many do not have. All this on top of the hate crimes, including lynchings against Muslims, Christians, Sikhs, and Dalits that have been on the rise for months. Activists in India and human rights organizations around the world have been ringing the alarm over the Indian government's efforts to make the country a Hindu-first nation. That's why hundreds of thousands of people have been taking to the streets from Kochi to Delhi to resist Hindu fascism and to call for a secular India. But well before the Citizenship Amendment Bill was enacted, there was a humanitarian crisis brewing in Kashmir. In August of 2019, the Indian government revoked the autonomous status of Kashmir and placed it under a communications and internet blackout. Reports of detention and torture have led international human rights bodies and members of the United States Congress to repeatedly raise concerns about the human rights violations that are happening in Kashmir to this day. Joining me to understand what is happening in India and in Kashmir and how people in the United States, particularly those of Indian, Hindu, and South Asian backgrounds, can practice meaningful solidarity are Noof Bazaz and Yashika Dutt. Thank you so much, Noof and Yashika, for being on Solidarity Is This.
Thanks, Deepa. Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Noof Bazaz is a clinical assistant professor at Loyola University, Maryland. Her clinical work and research focuses on trauma, torture, grief, and loss with survivors of war, violence, and persecution. Noof is also an artist and activist in the D.C. area and supports Kashmiri-led initiatives for advancing human rights. Yashika Dutt is an author and a journalist whose first book, Coming Out as Dalit, was recently released in the Indian subcontinent to an overwhelmingly positive reception. It has earned rave reviews from major Indian publications. Yashika hopes to bring powerful Dalit narratives into the global spotlight through her writing and her activism. All right. So thank you again for being on the podcast, both of you. And I wanted to start by asking you both to share a bit about the impact of what is happening in Kashmir and India on the communities that you're most connected to. What are the day-to-day concerns and fears that folks are dealing with? And why are you invested in making sure that people are aware of what is happening in India and Kashmir right now? Noof, let's start with you.
Sure. So my family is from Indian-occupied Kashmir. And even though I grew up in New York, I've kind of always had, you know, one foot on each continent. And, you know, right now, everything that's happening, you know, of course, none of this is new, you know, as far as some of the daily realities of living under the brutalization of an Indian military occupation and all of the different ways in which that really permeates the day-to-day living for a lot of my family members over in Kashmir. It's not new. In some ways, it's intensified over these past couple of months, but it's not new. And so for me, in all of the work that I do, I really think a lot about, you know, not just my family, but all of the folks right now in Kashmir who are trying to make a life right now, are trying to, you know, in whatever small ways that they can, the ways in which they can resist, but really the ways in which they can also just on a daily basis just survive.
earlier when I did the intro, I mentioned the communications blackout and the reports of human rights violations that began in August of 2019. Mm-hmm. That's still happening, right? Kashmir is still under a blackout.
You know, on August 5th, when the Indian government revoked, you know, what was at this point really just the last thread of autonomy that Kashmiris had held on to, that came with a communications blackout that included like a shutdown of the internet, that included shutting down mobile phones, texting, even landlines. Mm-hmm. And as severe as this communications blackout has been, even the United Nations has expressed condemnation of it. It's really even just one of the examples of how this Indian brutalization has manifested itself. So, you know, you have the communications blackout. You also have the clampdown on journalism, where again, multiple condemnations from the Committee to Protect Journalists have been issued. You also have then an uptick in armed forces. And so what a lot of folks don't realize is that Kashmir actually is the most militarized region in the world. And so it's close to about a million Indian armed forces. And this estimates anywhere between like a civilian to armed forces ratio of, you know, 10 to 1, 7 to 1. Mm-hmm. Before August 5th, they actually brought in tens of thousands of more troops. And for Kashmiris, more troops equates to more human rights violations. I mean, really, in the past, since August, there's been thousands of people who have been detained without cause. This includes the political class all the way down to young boys as young as 7, 8, 9 years old. There's reports coming out about the use of torture in these facilities. And again, it's nothing new for Kashmiris. This is just more of the same. And one thing right now is that I think it's getting a lot more international attention than I think India had anticipated. Because in the past, when they've been able to do things like this, it hasn't always necessarily caused the same ripples internationally. But you're seeing people internationally standing up, resisting and saying no to this.
So Yashika, I want to turn to you. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about what you're seeing. I know you're still connected to India in many ways and have family and friends networks there. What is your investment in what's happening right now? And what are the day-to-day concerns that communities that you're connected to are dealing with as a result of the Citizenship Amendment Bill and the NRC?
I just want to make it very clear that Dalits have been, if I may use the term, not so lightly under attack for the past 5.5 years, whether it's through lynchings, whether it's through asserted caste dominance by Brahmins, whether it's through Brahmin-only conferences and ministers from the government making statements like, why have all Nobel laureates been only Brahmins in the past so however many years? These are all systemic attacks, if I can say so, mm-hmm. on Dalits and on how we've been allowed to express ourselves, especially in the past 5.5 years, our identities. And with the Citizenship Amendment, CAA, Citizenship Amendment Act, which is an act now, and NRC combined together, of course, the biggest threat, the most obvious omission that comes from the list is for Muslims. But also, I think we need to take under consideration that there are Dalit Muslims as well who will suffer doubly because on the account of being left out from that list. And as you mentioned earlier, with NRC and CAA, what one needs to do, and they are inextricably linked, because what the NRC does is it makes you prove your citizenship. It takes an account of whether you're a citizen of the country or not. And CAA will only allow you to be a citizen of the country if you've been in the country before 2014, or if you were a Hindu citizen of Bangladesh or Pakistan, and I'm guessing it's Afghanistan, one other country.
Yes.
So what a lot of people don't understand is that these two acts are linked, and the way they're going to be implemented, they're going to take away citizenships away from a lot of Indians who have been in this country for generations. And as far as Dalits are concerned, I think one of the major challenges for Dalits is that Citizenship Amendment Act and NRC are the opposite of the idea of the constitution. They are kind of pushing a political ideology that is antithetical to what was Ambedkar's constitution. And here's why that's important. It's important because Ambedkar's constitution gives Dalits the rights to political expression, to political freedom, to assertion for affirmative action. It gives Dalits the rights to be equal citizens in the country. And NRC and CAA are an attempt to take the country in a completely different and opposite direction. In fact, NRC and CAA are threatening to Dalits. But if we just go further into the issue, what they want is for every citizen to prove whether they have papers or not to continue remaining citizens of the country. And there are so many Dalits who did not have the right to own land. Dalits, in fact, historically had no rights to own land till maybe a century or two ago. And so many of us still don't have the resources to prove that we have owned land or our generations have owned land, which is one of the, by the way, which is one of the main ways with which you can prove you're a citizen, not the passport, but if you have some land owning documents. When Dalits weren't allowed to own land in the first place, there is no way for them to prove that they are citizens, and they are automatically being, if they are landless laborers, if they're, which many Dalits historically have been, because they were not allowed to be farmers, they were not allowed to own land. So a lot of them moved from one state to the next, just acting as landless laborers. They're not carrying documents with them. Where is that person going to prove that they have the documents necessary for citizenship? And more than that, a lot of Dalits are historically tribal, sort of Adivasis, LGBTQ people. They're historically marginalized, historically are poor and landless people. How are they going to fight the Indian bureaucracy, which those of us who have had experience of being in India understand that it's a hellscape. And imagine giving Indian bureaucracy, Indian clerks, Indian babus, that much power over whether you're a citizen in this country or not. And when you push Dalits in that system, the only logical conclusion for their lives in the next maybe 10 years is them being in detention camps. Because that's, you know, when they're not able to prove their citizenship, when they're not able to prove that they have papers, then they have no other option but to end up in detention camps. So it's a really grave issue. And of course, you know, it's not a binary. It's not just that Muslims will be affected. It's just that Dalits will be affected. It's everybody who is non-heteronormative, non-Hindu, non-male, for example, as well. We will all be affected by the draconian combination of NRC and CAA. There is no other option but to speak up at this point, because as far as I see it, this is one of the most significant challenges to India that we've seen since the struggle for independence. It's the biggest movement that India has witnessed in 7 decades.
Yeah, and we're seeing that. I mean, I saw that, you know, 200,000 people protested in Kochi, in Kerala, just, you know, over, I think, on New Year's Day. And then we're also seeing people, students who are taking the charge, who are in the lead, for example, at JNU, a university in Delhi, where they're facing tremendous violence, mob violence, and are still trying to, as you say, lead the charge. So thank you for giving us that clarity, Yashika, about who this affects. And what would you say, Noof, in terms of some of the demands that Kashmiris have right now around self-determination?
For Kashmiris, there is no way forward without self-determination. You know, this has been a decades-long promise, you know, even just from, you know, multiple UN resolutions that have said that Kashmiri people deserve the right to their voice. And anything short of this just isn't going to cut it for us. Like for us, you know, Kashmiris, it's not necessarily about finding like a kinder, slightly more humane occupation, because we know that things like that, it only lasts for so long before there's another incident, before something happens to one of your children, before something happens to somebody in your family. Because again, you know, everything that's been happening these past couple of months, I know I've said it so many times now, but it's not new. So for decades, Kashmiris have faced really grave human rights abuses by India and their armed forces. So for example, one thing that a lot of people don't always associate with Kashmir is this issue of enforced disappearances. But really, since 1989, there have been an estimated 8,000 people who have been disappeared. And Years ago, actually, several thousand mass unmarked graves were found in Kashmir, many of which were believed to hold the bodies of these individuals who had been disappeared. And these are numbers and figures that, frankly, are fairly conservative and have been corroborated by international human rights organizations as well, like Amnesty International. There have been over 60,000 Kashmiris that have been killed. And this can include anything from extrajudicial killings, custodial killings, to being gunned down in their own streets. I mean, even when I think of my cousins in Kashmir, they've never known a life outside of militarization. You know, even like when my dad and my uncles, you know, when they tell me certain stories, as painful as those stories are, they, you know, there's some frame of reference. You know, even if at that point there was still this fight for self-determination and all of that, it was really this military occupation from 1989 that this generation has, they don't know anything else.
Right.
And just the different ways in which it's really robbed them of their present, their future, and then even in just thinking about what that past has been.
And I think what you said earlier was really important, and I wanted to repeat it, you know, that there is no humane form of occupation, right? There's no like kinder, gentler form of it. That is why self-determination, the promise that you said and alluded to that has been given to Kashmiris for so many decades, is something that people in Kashmir and activists elsewhere are fighting for and struggling for. And I think that that's really important for folks to know. So Yashika, same question to you. We talked a little bit about what's happening right now. You talked about the systemic exclusion of Dalit communities in particular. Can you talk a little bit about the way that Hindu fascism and the caste hierarchy has been excluding and marginalizing people for generations, and that this is not something that is, again, an overnight phenomenon?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, caste system is not at all an overnight phenomenon. It was instituted, at least by conservative estimates, thousands of years ago. So generationally, the trauma of being born in an untouchable caste, so to speak, is extremely heavy, and it carries through with you. I can give my example. I was born in a family of the caste that traditionally goes to clean toilets. And even, you know, somebody as far as not too far behind, both sides of my grandmothers indulged in manual scavenging work, which, I mean, in 2020 today, I sit here and on a podcast and it's easy for me to say, but even less than 5 years ago, to be able to say these words out loud carried so much shame and carried so much disgust with my own self that it took a lot of work for me to create empowerment around this idea that it just because they were forced into this work that is considered menial, that is considered dirty, that is considered, you know, something that creates people to be untouchable, it's not our fault. And that's the kind of trauma that caste system will give a Dalit person. They will make them doubt themselves. They will make them feel like they need to prove their worthiness to exist, or they need to prove that they are almost as equal as everybody else all the time. Mm-hmm. Or if they're not proving that, then they inherently accept themselves as inferior. So caste system creates generational traumas by telling you that you are inherently lower, that you are inherently worthy, that Brahmins and other upper castes, not just Brahmins, but all the other upper castes that are above Dalits are worthy of knowledge, are worthy of vanity, are worthy of respect and fundamental right to live, whereas Dalit lives somehow don't matter as much, or our well-being or our idea of self-respect does not matter. So these kind of ideas that tell you that you are so polluting that your shadow can make someone revolt in disgust, what does that do to a person, and what does that do to your self-worth? You can either choose to radically assert yourself, which people like me and so many others are learning, or you can just shrink and fear and wilt and feel that you are not worthy and you will always be inferior.
Thanks, Yashika, for sharing that. And I think that's why your book is really powerful. I was wondering if you could share a little bit about what prompted you. You said, you know, you speak up or you wilt. What prompted you to write the book in the first place? And what has been the response?
I wrote this book And when you read it, and I hope you get to soon, I wrote this book 3 to 4 times over, and I wanted to write it in a way that was accessible, that was plain, that was extremely simple, because I wanted a 15-year-old somewhere in a small town in India to be able to pick it up and say, I understand what is happening to me, and I will now be able to explain to my classmates when they call me that I don't deserve to be in this class because of affirmative action about why they're wrong. And that's why I wrote this book. And it was one of the best moments of my life so far when I got my DMs were filled with messages from students saying, Didi, you know, Didi is the way you address older sisters. Like, Didi, I'm so happy that I was finally able to tell my classmates about why I deserve to be here, why they were wrong to say that I did not have any merit just because I relied on affirmative action. And I think for me, that made the whole purpose of writing the book, that was fulfilled. And whether, I mean, I still want to be able to bring it to the United States and wanted to have a wider audience, but that itself was the biggest validation that I could get.
Yeah, and I think your book is also, I mean, obviously it's clear why it would appeal to and be so important for Dalit communities. I think that there are messages there that upper caste Hindus and Brahmins need to hear as well, because I think that there's a fair amount of denial about whether or not the caste system exists at all. And I say that particularly as someone who is myself born into a Brahmin household and has lived in this country in the United States for most of my life. But here in the US, I think that there's this feeling that, oh, that's something that happens back home, that that's not something that affects, you know, people here in the US, people who are Indian or Hindu in the US. And I think that that's an important myth that we all actually make sure that we rebut and show the reality around. Because, you know, you talked about the invisible arm of the caste system, but I think that that invisible or long arm of the caste system and Hindu fascism has extended to the United States. And there are many ways that we see this. There's a recent report from Equality Labs, which surveyed Dalits and revealed that 25% of respondents had faced verbal or physical assault because of their caste. And beyond individual discrimination, as you said, Yashika, there is the systemic piece. And here in the US, there is an organized Hindu right. And that Hindu right is behind a lot of what we're seeing right now. It's behind the erasure of caste in descriptions of Hinduism in California textbooks. It funds endowments of Hindu studies at universities, which are very focused on a particular agenda. It is behind the organizing of the Howdy Modi event that we saw in Houston in 2019, which Trump headlined. The Hindu right fuels a lot of the conservative approaches to immigration that we see that are pitting legal immigrants against undocumented people. And it even funnels support to elected officials, including some presidential candidates. And I think it's important for people who are in this country, and I want to kind of move to, you know, what can folks be doing here if they are Indian or Hindu, upper caste Hindus, South Asian, what can they be doing here right now? And Yashik, I'm going to just stay with you first and then come to Noof. You know, I think that it's very clear that people like me, right, who have tremendous privilege being upper caste Hindus, even if we don't practice it, and even if we eschew it and dismiss it, that there's still a role for folks to be playing in resisting Hindu fascism. And I was wondering if you had some thoughts on how Hindus and Indians and other South Asians can be most effective in terms of dismantling the caste hierarchy and ending Hindu fascism. How can we be useful allies?
You know, like you said earlier, how can we build intentional solidarity and not just be allies mm-hmm. who support a cause from distance? I think one of the first things we need to start doing, as with, you know, where people talk about how white people can be allies to people of color, Black people in particular, especially against their Trump-supporting parents, is to talk to your parents. I think that's one of the first things. And especially a lot of us here, we might understand in, you know, in our age group or like younger or millennials, so to speak, or Gen Z, we might understand why ideas against Hindu fascism, why ideas that are against caste supremacy make sense. But a lot of older folks or people from who are parents or grandparents, those ideas are so normalized to them that that is their way of life. And now the, you know, with the, this polarization against Modi, a lot of them support Modi so blindly, and they rely on, it's been talked about before, they rely on fake news, they rely on WhatsApp forwards. They are in these WhatsApp groups, which are basically breeding grounds for Islamophobic hate and caste hate more than ever. Go to protests. Make yourself seen. When you, as an Indian minority, as an Indian community in the U.S. are standing, and you mentioned the D.C. protests, there have been protests in New York, there have been protests in Atlanta, just show up in huge numbers and make the international community, the international media take notice that you're making yourself heard. I think it starts with that. And it's a moment that's of historic importance, and I can't say that enough, that we need to really give it our all at this point. Otherwise, imagine not being able to prove that you're a citizen. That's all it comes down to. And it's coming for all of us if we don't make ourselves heard.
I think the point that you've made, you know, the Indian government is basically legislating the caste system and Islamophobia through these efforts. And that's something that people need to really understand, which is why the call is so important, right? The call is to end Hindu fascism. And I just wanted to take a moment because, you know, for folks who are listening, if you hear the words Hindu fascism or Hindu supremacy and it sounds somewhat similar to white supremacy, you're on the right track, because that is exactly what Hindu fascism and Hindutva and Hindu supremacy is about. It is this feeling that the land belongs to Hindus, upper caste Hindus. It is this feeling that Hindus and upper caste Hindus are superior to others. And that is exactly why the efforts that we've been seeing in the United States, particularly led by Black people and Black communities, are ones that we can learn from in terms of being true allies and being in solidarity. So you mentioned a few things I just want to lift up, talking to parents and family members, especially in terms of identifying what is fake news and what is not. If you're a college student, convene a panel or a forum. There are college students who are actually working on anti-Hindutva efforts right now that you could join. Acknowledge your privilege and challenge the caste system at every turn. Learn your history and stand up. As you said, to protest or even to call on the media to actually share the information and share the content and experiences of protesters, and ask our elected officials in the United States and Congress, particularly we have Indian American members of Congress too, to actually take a stand. So those sorts of ways are things that people can do right here. And Nuf, same question to you. I always talk about this in terms of solidarity practice, which is that it's important to center the experiences of those who are directly affected and to actually follow their demands. And so I'm wondering if you can share with us, how can people be strong allies on Kashmir, even as they're mobilizing around the citizenship amendment bill and the NRC? How would you say that folks understand what is happening in Kashmir and center the experiences and demands of Kashmiris?
I would say, really, even just in the way that you phrased the question, it kind of answered the question to a degree as well, where, you know, what we want is for folks to be able to really amplify Kashmiri voices, Kashmiri perspectives, Kashmiri aspirations. You know, so often when we hear about the issue of Kashmir, it's always kind of broken down into this, oh, India versus Pakistan, or, oh, it's an Indian internal issue. And it's not. Like, this is genuinely about Kashmiris in Kashmir that want the freedom to live their lives, that want freedom from occupation, that want their children to be safe, to grow up, again, knowing what it means to be free.
Do you feel that this call for a secular India, you know, with what's happening right now, is in a way diminishing the call for self-determination? I've seen some critiques where folks who are focused on Kashmir are asking for sort of a delineation.
No, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think that folks within India, which again include many Kashmiris who might be living in India, you know, I think that these protests are such a huge watershed moment. I mean, we're seeing so many people mobilizing, and they should be mobilizing. You know, I think that these calls for a secular India, these calls against this very right-wing Hindu fascism, our issue is different. You know, when we say we want Azadi, when we say we want independence, you know, we want independence from India. You know, we're not looking for equal rights within India. You know, I think that equal rights within India is phenomenally important to so many communities living within India, and it's a fight that should be fought. And at the same time, ours is just different. We are looking for that right to self-determination. We are looking for most freedom from India. Many Kashmiris, they don't necessarily consider themselves to be Indian. And so in the same, so, you know, we want to lend our solidarity and support however it is that we can. You know, I'm learning even just so much from hearing Nashika speak. You know, for me, I'm thinking, wow, like, I want to be able to help and help support those causes and support those issues, but I'm not supporting them as an Indian. It's something that I can lend support and solidarity to as a Kashmiri, but our issues, even though they are similar and they're related, they're fundamentally different. But that doesn't necessarily mean that any one is more deserving than the other.
Absolutely. But I'm so glad you kind of laid that out, because I think when, again, we talk about solidarity, there is this sense of just sort of blanketing everything with hashtags, right, that seem all the same. And I think that the point that you've made is so important, because we need to understand to not conflate and to understand the differences between what folks are asking for, even if they seem to be coming from the same region, right? So thank you so much for being really clear about that. I think that that'll help folks who are organizing these protests and these rallies around the country to understand, if they want to talk about Kashmir, that they need to do it in a particular way, following, as you said, the voices and experiences and needs and demands of Kashmiris. I really appreciate both of you for your honesty, your directness, and obviously the work that you do and the advice you've given us. This is a historic moment, not just for Indians, but I think for those of us who are connected to India in any way, and really anyone committed to justice and liberation. And so hopefully folks who are listening to this podcast will take the opportunity to learn more, to identify what their role is and how they can speak up in this really important moment right now. So thank you to both of you for joining. I hope that you enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to learn more from you, Yashika. I really appreciate everything that you had to offer. Thank you.
Yeah, I can say the same for myself. It was wonderful to, and like exactly what you said, you know, especially when it comes to Kashmiri voices, I think what we need to do is amplify them first. And it was such an honor and a privilege to hear Noop speak.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Solidarity Is This. Please do share, subscribe, and reach out to me with your feedback and ideas. You can find me on Twitter at DVIYER. I'm sending each of you peace and healing on your journeys, and I will catch you on the next episode of Solidarity Is This.